afternoon, Katie and Kay listeners. It's time for Valley Voices. I'm Marilyn Gleason, your host for today. We are going to be talking about fire and water today with some of our true Valley experts on the subject. Kate Collins is here. She's with the Middle Colorado Watershed Council. And Sam Feuerborn, also joining me today, a new person on the scene with the Colorado River Wildfire Collaborative. He's a new program manager, so stick around. Well, good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you, Kate Collins.
Hi, Marilyn. It's great to be back.
And Sam Feuerborn.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. Kate, let's talk about, first of all, the Middle Colorado River is the foundation of the communities between Glenwood Springs and Debeck, and that's the area where you're keeping track of the health of the river in many different aspects. It supports agricultural lands, native fish, municipal water supplies, and the great old river recreation and all those rafters.
Yes, it does, and municipal water and oil and gas and a host of other things.
Okay. And Sam Feuerborn is here as a newly hired employee, the new program manager for the Colorado River Wildfire Collaborative. And what I was kind of figuring out as I came in here this afternoon, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the Wildfire Collaborative in the Roaring Fork, but this is actually kind of a new project.
Yeah. It was founded in 2021 by my predecessor, Paula Stepp, after the Grizzly Creek and the Pine Gulch fires. It has a memorandum of understanding of 40 different entities, all the fire departments and fire districts, all the agencies, BLM, Forest Service, Colorado State Forest Service, CPW, etc., all the municipalities in the county voluntarily entered into this agreement that's a multi-jurisdictional kind of loose structure for the purpose of mitigating for wildfire and preparing for the effects of post-fire. The difficulty was that we had no funding.
Oh, yeah.
So we were continuing to meet every month with the stakeholders and identify projects. But we didn't have any money to execute on mitigation of the projects.
So how do the Collaborative and the Watershed Council like interact?
How do they work?
Mm-hmm.
So the Wildfire Collaborative was initially going to be its own nonprofit. So initially the idea was it would spin off into its own nonprofit. In today's funding environment, we have determined that creating another nonprofit was probably not the greatest thing to do. And so it's basically a very, very important project of the Middle Colorado Watershed Council. So I would say I'll go out on a limb and say maybe it's half of what we are doing these days because water and wildfire are so inextricably linked.
And now you have an employee.
Yes. And we were able to get a grant from Colorado State Forest Service. It's a total funding package of $350,000. We had 10 local match partners on that, which was really exciting. They came up with $87,500, and that was like Chevron and Holy Cross Energy, a couple of fire districts, Debeck and Colorado River Fire Rescue, the county, the municipalities of Rifle, Silt, Parachute, and Silt. And that funding gave us the ability to hire a person for 3 years. So we hadn't wanted to hire someone if we didn't know that we had funding secure for more than a year. And that was just really a game changer. And so we we started our recruitment process this spring, and we hired Sam in May, and so he's been on the job just a little more than 3 months.
An old timer.
Yeah. It's been so incredible, though, because Sam is very self-directed and he's very mission-driven, and so in many ways it feels like he's always been with us.
Well, I just have to ask, Sam, what is the mission?
Great question. The mission, as Kate was saying, is to bring this multi-jurisdictional entity together to enact landscape scale fire mitigation for the benefit of the broader community. And I've been describing my service area broadly as Garfield County minus the Roaring Fork watershed.
Because they already have their own.
They've got their own. Not to say we don't work together. Those lines don't blur occasionally, but yeah.
Okay. Well, that's big landscape scale. And there's a lot going on the landscape this year. What programs are underway right now?
So there's always conversations about projects at that landscape scale, but there's also more bite-sized chunks that we've been taking a look at. And one great example of that, a recent rollout of our home ignition zone assessment program, is a free program that's offered to Garfield County residents. And basically, I come out, take a look at folks' homes, do a little walk around with them to field any questions or concerns that they might have. And then I provide them with a confidential report that outlines what sort of options exist for them to harden their home against a potential wildfire event. And so that might look like screening vents or removing a firewood pile up against the house or potentially thinning fuels working out from the house across their property. And in that report, I try and pinpoint what the most accessible sort of options are or what the cheapest, easiest ones, since everyone loves to see those, and stretch that spectrum out into kind of, you could bulldoze your house and rebuild with a fireproof bunker if you wanted to. I don't actually put that in the report, but you get the point.
Right. And this is a confidential report. I remember you mentioning that to me before.
Yeah, I think that's something that has really stood out to a lot of folks in the service area. I don't share this with insurance providers. That's oftentimes the top question is, oh, if I've got a bunch of stuff that I need to do around my house, is this going to ding my premium or anything like that? And so I always let folks know that this is between the homeowner and myself. I share it with them and then go through and delete all the photos, if only to free up space on my phone. And if they choose to share it with their local fire district or insurance broker, that's totally up to them. And I'm supportive of any way that they use that report.
And is there some sort of certification process with the fire departments, or are there any ways that these reports, like once people go and do all of the mitigation, that they get some benefit besides their house not burning to the ground?
Great question. Not currently. They might use some of this information to share with a broker. I know there have been a few folks that have received letters from their insurance providers kind of outlining, hey, we want you to do X, Y, and Z mitigation items to remain insured. And so a report like this could serve the documentation to show that they've completed those measures. There have been conversations, as you might imagine. The insurance market or the insurance world right now is definitely in flux with some recent legislation, and there are certifications like FireWise. That's probably the most widely known certification available, which is more at a neighborhood or HOA scale. There are also certifications available for individual homeowners. I'm not currently providing those, but I know folks are working on integrating that into these sort of assessments that people would also require come away with a certificate around their home.
So aren't some of these assessments already happening with the local fire departments?
Yeah, there are. I know Colorado River Fire and Rescue has partnered with Fire Aside, and they're conducting some of these assessments. And the intention with the Colorado River Wildfire Collaborative program is to help fill the gaps between individual districts. Districts don't always catch everyone, and not all districts and municipalities have programs like this available, and maybe not free either. So we're filling in some of the gaps and making sure everyone's got an opportunity to access these resources.
And Sam, you're trying to really bring this to all of the rest of Garfield County that isn't already covered.
Correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what are your best tips? What are the things that people really need to be thinking about around their home?
Best tips, as I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but looking at your home itself, and one thing that I share with everyone that I'm doing these assessments is thinking about how wildfire spreads to homes, and that's typically through blowing embers. So you can imagine, or there's plenty of videos if folks want to jump on YouTube. It looks like a hailstorm of embers kind of blowing through. And so you can think about when, certainly in my home, I've seen where embers have piled up against siding or on my deck, around potted plants. Same sort of story with embers. Looking at places where they can accumulate either up against a home or a residence, or where they could get into a residence. And so that could be open vents along the eaves or in the attic. It could be open doors or windows. And looking at ways to mitigate that. And so the gold standard is 1/8-inch hardware store mesh that you can seal those vents up. Still allows airflow, but prevents embers from getting in. But then also looking at flammable materials like firewood stacks. That's a repeat offender that I've seen.
Right up against the house.
Yep. It's, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't take a real crazy imagination to think about how firewood can ignite and spread to a structure that way. Or oftentimes I'll see that even under a deck, which, you know, double whammy there potentially. But, you know, broadly speaking, looking at mulch, that's a little bit of a red flag. Oftentimes when it's up against the house, we speak about the 0 to 5 feet, extending 5 feet out from the wall or structures of a home and trying to remove all flammable materials in that space. Oftentimes mulch or junipers, flammable landscaping, split rail fences or privacy fences. These are all things that I often identify in my reports as potential threats. And I use the candle analogy. These are just wicks that can reach the body of the candle.
And what about trees and brush and foliage?
Absolutely. That one is maybe a little more nuanced. It depends is the short answer. I typically flag branches or trees that are touching structures, especially on the roof, or if there's a bunch of dead branches or leaves that accumulate in gutters or especially at roof angle changes. Keeping those clean, covering gutters is kind of nice. It prevents embers from building up in gutters and it saves the homeowner maintenance. So that's one I frequently recommend. And then, as I mentioned, the flammable landscaping. If you've got a dead dry tree, a pinyon juniper, heavy scrub oak right around your home, that's something that's definitely worth taking a look at, potentially removing or limbing up.
It surprises me that it's just 5 feet. And is that to give firefighters just some access to the house?
It's some access. Just to be clear, the 5 feet isn't an end-all, be-all.
Right.
In the assessment, I typically break it up into, or not typically, I do break it up into 0 to 5 feet, 5 to 30 feet, and 30 to 100 feet. And so as you can imagine, the closer you get to the home, the more drastic of measures you typically want to take. And that 0 to 5 feet is typically the most approachable. It's where people are spending most of their time around their home and are most familiar with, and is oftentimes some of the most accessible. Not to say you can't benefit in great ways from doing fuels thinning further out. I think a lot of the studies show 0 to 60 feet as being the magic number that can really improve a structure's odds of survival. But like I said, that 0 to 5 is a really phenomenal starting point.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing. And I know firefighters, you know, take a look at these houses and decide whether they really want to go in there or not.
Absolutely. The triage is real and is an ongoing discussion amongst a lot of folks is how do I make my home look like it's been worked on so that firefighters feel safe and like it's worth protecting? And also, yeah, what do you have to do to make it look visibly treated? Sometimes it can feel pretty drastic.
On Valley Voices today, you've been listening to Sam Feuerborn. He's the new program manager for the Colorado River Wildlife Collaborative. And we also have Kate Collins in the studio. Sam, I did want to ask you a little bit about your background. which is conservation leadership, outdoor education, collaborative land stewardship, and you've been at Wilderness Workshop for a while before this. How did Wilderness Workshop prepare you for this work?
Great question. Yeah, I think working at the workshop, I was introduced to a bunch of, if not immediate players in this wildfire game, folks that are tangential to the work. And so just making those personal connections, I found to be hugely beneficial. I'm not just blindly reaching out or cold calling folks. It's people that I have had an established relationship with, which has been fun to reconnect. And it's also prepared me from working on collaboratives in the area, working with stakeholders and partners to get work done. The flavor might have shifted a little bit, but the apparatus or the way we're getting the work done hasn't shifted too much, from scheduling meetings and taking notes and doing outreach and preparing materials and facilitating meetings. That's all at a fundamental level the same, right? And so from public land conservation to wildfire preparedness doesn't feel, at least to me, like a huge leap.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kate Collins, you've been at the Middle Colorado Watershed Council for a little under 2 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow, good memory, Marilyn.
Well, I've been here a little under 2 years myself, and you were an early interview when I came in, you and Paula Stepp, when you were taking over. How have your priorities shifted or morphed in the last 2 years, or what you're focused on?
Mm-hmm. That is a very good question. I think when you look at the vastness of our region of 75 river miles and 2,200 square miles, all the tributaries in that watershed, it's a huge mandate. And so really being able to focus in on specific areas or specific issues, you just have to approach the work that way. In general, a healthier watershed, one that is has good riparian health, good water quality and quantity, is a more resilient watershed for all these things, including wildfire. So, in general, that's how we look at it. But then we take specific projects and really zero in on those. And so, a huge focus for us has been Rifle Creek restoration, which is from Rifle Gap Reservoir to the creek's confluence with the Colorado River, which is about 6.5 miles. And excited to say we're advancing some of those projects that have been identified. When Sam was talking about the work, I almost butted in and said, "And let's not forget grant writing, pursuing funding sources and funding partners and pulling all that together."
Well, one of these funders, I think, that we're talking about today is the BLM Fuels Management and Community Fire Assistance Program. Is that true? Which they're talking about wildland fuels management, and their activities embody strategic investments in managing vegetation by reducing the intensity, severity, or negative effects of wildfire. And, Kate, when you were in the springtime running a series of events on fire and water, the one that I made it to was really great down in Rifle, and there was a film, Elemental, which was talking about that kind of landscape scale envisioning of how we deal with fire and becoming resilient. And they were not real hot on the fuels reduction in the forests. What I came away from that film was we're much better off hardening our houses, kind of building fire lines around our communities. And, for decades, we've really been talking about the suppression of fire being our biggest problem today, 100 years of suppressing fires instead of letting them burn. So I'm just throwing that out there. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I will say that Sam worked very, very hard and submitted a grant on Friday at the deadline to the Bureau of Land Management for this grant that will work along the wildland-urban interface and then also on some public lands. And he has no shortage of lands identified. So,
yeah, I think that community assistance grant is a perfect example of the yes and approach in that Grant, working with stakeholders, we identified a bunch of different places on the landscape that would connect the dots between some mitigation efforts that have been ongoing for years and improve the efficacy of those treatments. I think fuels reductions on the landscape is important, and I think doing it right is the most critical piece. That depends location to location and fuels type. So I do think the fuels management piece is super important. Honestly, I think more fire on the landscape in a prescribed fashion would be phenomenal to see. That is, we live in a fire adapted ecosystem. These are all plants and animals that work well with fire when it's done in a way that isn't super destructive. So thinking about fire not on red flag days when it has us thinking of the worst and
those blowing embers.
Exactly. And thinking about having folks on the ground that are experts in their field, have resources positioned and know exactly, okay, this is where we want the fire for this purpose. That's what dreams are made of in many ways. And the other piece of the grant, not that it's funding necessarily prescribed fire, but fuels treatments. The other piece is home hardening and written into that grant that would fund a homeowner assistance program to help fund work hardening their homes, working in that 0 to 5 foot zone that I mentioned to help them get going. Once they've got the report in hand, sometimes a financial barrier is real for folks. And so to help incentivize or get that work done, that's part of the marriage there. It's not just landscape scale, but also, you know, in the neighborhoods as well.
And another thing I wanted to ask about, again, from that film, the scale of even these large fires on the whole landscape isn't that big. It has more to do with, again, how close they are to communities, if there's people out living in the forest, that kind of thing, is, I gather, the bigger problem. And yet what I've seen this summer is just... we've now got these kind of satellite ways of detecting the fires, and they're really being doused immediately. Like, we are really going out and putting those fires out this summer. Is that where we want to be going?
I think there are certainly some historic precedents in fire suppression that have proven to not be beneficial on a landscape scale, and I know there's been a lot of talk about out by 10 coming back. And so the idea that a fire, once it's discovered, is out by 10 a.m. the next day. As I was mentioning, I don't think full-scale suppression like that is necessarily always appropriate. It gets nuanced, so it's hard to really take too firm of a stance here.
Right, especially in a year like this year when we're in such a drought.
Absolutely. Like, the fuels out there are so dry. And again, as you were mentioning, you know, the proximity to homes and towns, seeing some of the fires that have burned recently and been so destructive, whether it's Spokane or LA or the Marshall Fire, no one here, right, wants a repeat of anything like that. And given the conditions on the ground, you know, it's not totally out of the question if we had a terrible month or two. Hopefully we're coming out of it now and working on the other side, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for a great ski season this year. So
I'm with you. Well, Kate, the Middle Colorado focuses on wildfire resilience, which explains what we're doing here. Riparian, that riverbank and river habitat, the recreation, and also water quality and quantity. Can you talk to me about the water in the Middle Colorado right now, this year? I know down there, I've been down, there was a great article by Aspen Journalism about the reach below the Palisade, all those canals, all those really old water rights down in Grand Junction and Palisade, and there is barely any water in the river down there.
That's right. I learned today that in the 15-mile reach where the 4 endangered fish are living, and that we keep flows in there because there are endangered fish in there, that it's just running at 100 CFS, cubic feet per second, today.
Which is like a ditch.
Yeah, I mean, you just can walk right across it. So one thing that people here on the Roaring Fork and the Frying Pan may have noticed are the releases from Rude Eye Reservoir, which have been a real godsend.
Right, and are those aimed at, I kind of have a few ideas of what those are aimed at, the Grand Valley, where we were just talking about, for one thing, and then the fishing waters there right below the dam. But yeah, tell me a little more about Rude Eye and its role that it's playing.
Yes, so Rude Eye is a storage reservoir, and it filled to about 70%, I think, of its capacity this year. So Green Mountain Reservoir is also a storage reservoir. It filled to 50%, and there's a thing called the Historic Users Pool, HUP, where releases are made from those reservoirs to keep irrigation viable, primarily in the Grand Valley. And the Historic User Pool releases were out, I believe, at the end of July, which is pretty much unprecedented. So the Rude Eye releases were really timely and really wonderful, also just for recreation. I mean, for being able to get out on the Roaring Fork and get in our inflatable kayaks and paddle, was wonderful to see the water again.
Well, we are running up against our time here, so here's the question that you were not expecting. Sam Feuerborn, I know enough German to know that that has something to do with fire, perhaps born to fire, more or less. And it always interests me when I see people whose names seem to be fitting their jobs exactly. Do you think you were destined to be doing this?
Oh, man, big question to close out the interview. Maybe. Well, I can get back into the etymology. Before my family moved to the U.S., my last name was Jakob Feuerborn. So a bunch of generations passed, and it got anglicized, smoothed out to just Feuerborn. And so the family lore is that somewhere way back when, there's Jacob born of fire, or maybe he was like a firefighter. Not totally sure, but that's where the name, I guess, came from. Maybe came from. And so, yeah, we're sticking with
born of fire.
We need
to get that in your bio on the website. She's just like a multi-layered onion full of surprises.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. We've been talking to Kate Collins. She's from the Middle Colorado Watershed Council. And as we just said, Sam Feuerborn, born to fire, working for the Colorado River Wildfire Collaborative. So thank you so much, both for joining me today.
It was great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Some cloudless night in September, when the air is clear, take a seat outside. Turn your binoculars to the sky. With patience and a bit of luck, you may see birds flying across the yellow face of the moon. September is peak migration time for millions of songbirds heading south from temperate North America to more tropical latitudes. Most migrate at night. Orioles, warblers, sparrows, and tanagers. Nocturnal migrants of the same species call as they fly, enabling flockmates to stick together. Many of these flight calls are distinctive, enabling those with an excellent ear or good recording gear to identify them as they pass. Like many nocturnal travelers, the Swainson's thrush avoids predators by flying at night, because hawks migrate during the day. But mostly, night migration's attractive because the cooler, more stable air makes flight more efficient and prevents overheating, meaning that even a tiny bird like a warbler that weighs around a third of an ounce can cover as much as 200 miles in a night. Your moonwatch vigil may reveal only a few dozen such birds on the move, but researchers along the Gulf of Mexico have tracked more than a million birds headed to Central America on one busy night. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.